outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Well, Kyle, I did something last week I haven't done in over a year.
Okay.
I went golfing.
You did? How did it go?
It was really strange. You know, I haven't played in a year. This is going to be bad. And plus my back, I did go to a driving range last week to try and see if that would at least could hit a ball and my back wouldn't hurt too much. I was hitting it not far at all. So I get on the first hole, I drive it straight down the fairway to my normal length. And then I hit a second shot up by the green, par five, hit it up by the green, 50 yards short, chipped it on, two putted for par. Next hole, par three, hit on the green, two putted for par. Next hole, in the middle of fairway, on the green, three putted for bogey. And end up shooting five over on nine holes.
You shot five over on nine holes in the first time in a year?
Yes.
After back surgery and cancer?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
That is insane. I cannot believe it.
And I only played nine holes, so I didn't know how my back would do after. It was okay. So I guess
Wow.
Now I'm gone the next 2 weeks, so I don't get to play much golf, but at least I can do it again.
You're not going to play on the East Coast while you're out there?
No, we're not playing on the East Coast. I'm literally speaking for two solid days and then flying back. So there will be no time for fun on this trip. Going into Atlanta and Greenville, but I haven't announced it anywhere because there's no time for it to be open for others to join us. So
yeah.
And then I'm back here for 2 days, and then Sarah and I are off to Tulsa, Oklahoma for our 50th college reunion.
Wow.
No golf there either. It's too cold.
No golf at Oral Roberts for your 50th. Okay.
I'll get back here at noon. I'll get back here in mid-November and maybe try that again.
Are there still people that you keep in contact with from your college years?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got them all the way back from my childhood, my college years, my institutional religious organization years, my out-of-the-box years. I've got people from all over in my life.
That's wild. I have a few people that I still am kind of in touch with from my college years, but not that much. And it wasn't that long ago.
Well, our college years were it was a community. I mean, they're just neat relationships that have gone over the years and watch people's spiritual journeys take different directions. It's been really awesome. So it's fun to go back and reconnect with them and see how that goes.
Nice. Well, it makes my heart very happy to hear that you were able to step back out on a golf course again, because I know that's one of your true joys. And so to be able to reconnect with that makes me really happy for you.
Yeah. If I hadn't hit into the water on the seventh tee, I would have even scored better.
So you had to take a drop?
I did. The 170 yards to clear the water. I just disfanned it a little bit and didn't make it.
Jeez.
I did make a 50-foot putt across the hole downhill.
Oh, my gosh.
Bending left to right. And I mean, it's the hardest putt, one of the hardest putts on the golf course. And I was hoping to three putt. That's what I was hoping. And it went in.
Jeez.
Crazy nuts.
So you're saying you need to have back surgery more often then?
No, I'm figuring I won't golf again because I won't golf better than that. So, that could be my last round. And I could, like the last time I played home run derby, I hit a home run, dropped the bat, walked off, and haven't played again. So my last at bat was a home run.
Okay. That's not a bad record to leave on.
That was only 10 years ago or so. So not bad.
Okay. Okay. Now,
probably 20 years ago, actually. Anyway, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. Best thing you heard last week, Kyle.
I bumped into a quote yesterday when I was doing a training by Virginia Satir. And it says, she's a psychologist, psychotherapist, and I was doing training for one of my programs. And it says, we prefer the certainty of misery to the misery of uncertainty.
Ooh, that's true.
Oh, yeah. That one, I was like, oh, I'm taking a picture of that one because that one is a little too close to home sometimes.
That kind of describes Israel's bent to go back to Egypt, right?
Yes, very much so. Absolutely.
The misery we understand rather than the uncertainty of what it's going to be like to live in the wilderness for a long time.
Instead of following this pillar of fire that just walked us through an ocean, we're going to go back to the people who enslaved us. But at least we had food and we did have shelter. So
shows how much people love certainty.
Gosh,
at least I know what's coming at me. I can somehow manage it. I can't imagine me surviving a future I can't see.
Oof.
And I can. My goodness, I love the mystery of if God's enough today, he's going to be enough tomorrow. He's going to be enough the next day, no matter what comes my way. And the future doesn't look hopeful in terms of externals.
Yeah.
But boy, I think God's in them.
Well, it's interesting because I was actually thinking about when you talked about the Exodus, I was actually thinking about that when I saw this quote. And that generation of God's people, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that they didn't know his heart super well because they'd been crying out to him for being able to be set free from the slavery that they'd been a part of. And a lot of them had been, most of them had been born into that. That was their norm.
That was like their 400 years, right?
So yeah.
They were all born into
it. They were all born into it. And so it's like,
they were 10th generation slaves.
And so to be able to conceptualize, okay, now this God who we've been asking for deliverance for 400 years shows up. He does deliver us. Now he's got us out in the desert and is asking us just to trust him and follow him into the unknown. I mean, it's a little bit bigger of an ask than I initially like perceive it as, because like, yeah, he did all these crazy miracles and then led them out of Egypt. And yet this is a fairly new conversational relationship that a lot of these people had with him, I feel like.
And he's feeding them every day and he's providing water for them, but they couldn't see where the next meal was coming from yet, even though the promise was there and it was there every morning. It just seemed like, oh my gosh, let's go back to Egypt, because at least we knew what we were dealing with.
Or the one that really cracks me up is, you know what? Let's just make a golden calf out of gold. You know, out of gold, out of some of our jewelry that we have. Let's just go ahead and make that, because that's also in our control. And yeah, it might not get us very far, but at least it's physically there in front of us that we can control it, worship it, whatever.
Goodness. And we've talked about that a lot on this God Journey podcast, that we prefer the comfort of knowing something.
Yeah.
To the uncertainty of God with us no matter what. I think people who are comfortable in God, where uncertainty doesn't matter, have the fullest life.
Well, because then they can enjoy the mystery. They don't need to know the next steps. They know at the core of who they are, I am doing life with a God that I deeply trust, that loves me absolutely, without resistance, without fault. He's never going to leave me. And so, yes, there may be painful seasons that I go through. There may be challenges that I go through. It may not be my ideal road. And yet I am not doing it alone. I am doing it with the author and perfecter of my faith.
And it does, I think a lot of the language, particularly the Old Testament, does set us up for expectations about God that seem defied by circumstance. like Sarah and I were reading this weekend about, I'm coming and God, you're going to set everything right. And we're still waiting 4,000 years since that was written, and he still hadn't said everything right. And, you know, he's going to get the liars, and the liars thrive in our culture. Sarah and I are reading a lot of that stuff, or Psalm 103, heals all your diseases. Well, he didn't do that for Israel. He didn't do that. He doesn't do that for us, even though people claim that. And just if you jump through the right hoops, you get healed. Over the long haul, it doesn't work. And so what do we say about those scriptures? Because I think those torment people who you heal all our diseases, you will not allow affliction to come near the tent of the righteous. There's all kinds of language in scripture. And I read something last week by Walter Brueggemann I thought was interesting, how the prophets and the Old Testament writers talked about an idealized future that never came for them, whether it was the lack of enemies, the everything being taken care of for you. They never experienced that idealized future. And some of that we've harvested into Christianity, and we still look, and people get online and promise us the idealized future. And then most people live like, okay, that doesn't happen. All those things don't happen, at least that way. Yeah. And are they describing eternity? I think they probably are. And yet they were thinking it was going to happen now for us. And the disillusionment you live in, if you've created this ideal future where God takes care of every bad thing, either before it happens to me or when it happens to me, and then you don't know how to live in the world when those things don't happen, then it gets to, maybe I can't trust God, because where's God in all this? And maybe God doesn't exist. And I know many people who've gotten there.
Yeah.
Maybe this is all a Santa Claus kind of look, because he doesn't even do what the scriptures seem to say he must do. And there's a lot of this. Sarah and I are just making notes reading the Old Testament. Yep, hadn't done that yet. And this was, these were things they were writing 3,000-4,000 years ago. And they haven't happened yet. Someday.
And I think part of the challenge too is when you have people like some of the prosperity gospel figures or some of these people that say, but see, look, he did it for me. You know, I haven't really had any major challenges. I've got my own private jet with my name on the side of it and my 10,000, you know, square foot mansion and blah, 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 blah. I mean, they list all these this laundry list of blessings. And it's like, so obviously God does it for some of us, because look at my life. And it's, oof, oh man.
It's like infomercials on flipping houses. Why are those guys not flipping houses? Because they're doing infomercials on flipping houses. So they're getting their money from you. They're not getting it from flipping houses. And I think that's true of a lot. If you're getting millions of dollars from your faithful supporters, then yes, God is a great God and life is great. But the people who are listening to that, who are trying to make it happen for them, a few out of thousands and thousands may hit some upper financial freedom, but most aren't. And it's the struggle again, because it comes back to, why isn't God being faithful to me?
Yeah.
What have I done wrong? Or whether that's the two things. Either I've done something wrong that keeps God from doing that for me, or the whole God thing is a crock and I'm chasing something that doesn't exist. The idea, I think, of fullness, which we talked about last week, the idea of fullness is, no, there's a fullness of life inside of God now that's not circumstantial.
Yes.
It transcends the circumstance. And so all that stuff is there in Christ, but it's not necessarily he's fixing all my externals to make me feel better.
What about you? That was a good conversation off of what my little quote for the week.
That's a whole podcast right there. We can be done. Take the rest of the day off.
Mike dropped that thing.
Sarah and I are still watching. We watched some of it before we left on our trip. We're still watching some of it now. It's the documentaries on the national parks by Ken Burns.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
And he quotes John Muir, and he's talking about this pristine natural land that's so beautiful it ought to be preserved.
Yeah.
And he's fighting this before we had national parks. So he's fighting to establish national parks because people have moved in and they're taking this beautiful land and they're building stuff and selling stuff to make money off of it for other people to come, or they're harvesting the wood and they're destroying the beauty of it. So he said, John Muir says this: if a dollar value can be attached to a sacred place, it is vulnerable. Nothing dollarable is safe. And I thought about the word sacred, which is how he saw that. And you think about same thing with Christianity.
Yeah.
It's a sacred space that's dollarable. And once you decide to make the dollars off of it, it's not safe. Then it becomes something less. And we as humanity have the ability to destroy anything for the purpose of making money off of it. As we are reading about the Amazon and what they're doing down there we've used our land in major ways to make money from it. And then other countries want to do the same thing, but you're destroying the planet. And in some ways they are, but I don't know. There's some tough decisions to be made coming up. But I thought about, if it's dollarable, it's not safe. And I've got every app on my iPhone and everything on my computer that says that's exactly true. Once you can make money off of it and somebody is going to maximize, that's why we still don't have video. There is no way right now we can stream to Facebook. They've changed all the configurations, and as much reading as I've done online, I've got somebody on it working on me now, so we can try and get it there someday. Got a letter last week from our podcast, kind of ties into some of what we're talking about now. And this is Jack from the Carolinas.
Okay.
Maybe the most meaningful podcast for me in a long time. The living from fullness of Christ is what you have been living and teaching for years. I was pondering the word disciple the other night. Seems we might have lost the intent behind it. Perhaps the teaching of discipleship should be about living from the fullness of Christ in us and how to give that away. How to live from that. Wow.
Oof.
I love that, because I had that discussion with someone this morning that's talking about formulating some kind of discipleship modality for a group of people. And what does that look like? In fact, was invited to do a discipleship workshop. And he said, man, when I get done with it, I gave him a lot of information. But did I really teach them anything? Because discipleship is about presence.
Yeah.
And it's about how do you cultivate the environment internally that leads you to fullness? And then how do you live out of that fullness instead of live out of a lack of fullness? And I've got to get it from my friends, my circumstances, my job, my wife, my husband, whatever I've got. If I'm not living from fullness, then I'm having to get it from everything around me. And Jesus and I had some conversation about that just this week in my own life. Am I living from fullness? If I'm not living from fullness, then some of the things that I want or trying to have happen that frustrate me, and there's not much of that these days, but I look at it going, okay, if I was full, I wouldn't be looking for that in the same way that I am.
Interesting.
So okay. Jesus, what is it about your love? I don't know that if I knew it, I'd be full here. And our discussion led to some other conversations this week. And I love that whole idea of, okay, we were designed to live from fullness in a world that can't provide it. So even if you have all the money in the world and you still doesn't mean you have fullness of life. And you can be in great need and peril and have fullness inside because God is present and everything you desire never meant to be fulfilled in this age, as we just got done talking about. And I tell you, I think if we designed our ideas of discipleship around love, obviously being loved and loving, and that with presence, not just God as an idea, but God as present and fullness, that in Him, my life is full, even if I've got challenges. And even if we are making decisions in deference to brokenness, and it is robbing some of the things I'd rather be doing, if my fullness is in Him, it just doesn't matter.
We got into a really interesting debate today, literally the class that I just came from, my sociology class, and we were talking about the impact of religion on their worldview and what did that look like and how has that grown. And it was really intriguing because there was a lot of discussion about how religion is man-created and a lot of frustration about it falling short, about the frustration of why are these systems not working, or why are these systems not meeting my needs? Or we got into the conversation of why is religion such a hot topic? What makes religion and politics the two conversations that universally we're like, we're just not going to go there at the dinner table. Like, just don't go there. What is it about religion that causes that level of activation? And it's intriguing because there was a lot of discussion in the class about different areas and challenges and places where people have fallen and failed, and references to the Crusades and all these different things. And yet for me, one of the things that I really had to lean into and was processing was, yes, but His presence, the religion that I grew up under and the worldview that I grew up under, that led me to a place of depression, a place of suicidal ideation, a place of hopelessness. And yet His presence was what freed me. And that to me was just so intriguing, because it was like, okay, so this man-made system thing that I grew up in that harnessed my worldview, it really twisted and basically enslaved, imprisoned my heart. And yet His presence and dwelling in that, learning what it means to live from that space, to connect with that space, to recognize that in the world around me and in my heart as I'm moving through the world, like His presence of love was what was able to eviscerate over 4.5 years of a continuous episode of major depressive disorder. And one collision of presence with His Holy Spirit was enough to say, no, this is done. which is mind-blowing to me.
That's partly why religion has taken the presence out of it.
Hmm. Okay, tell me more. What do you mean by that?
Well, instead of presence, it offers doctrine and rules and feeling good about yourself because you conform to the group ideology. And if you're good at it, you can rise inside of it. But almost all of, once something living becomes a religion, and that includes Christianity in my mind, yeah. Once it becomes a religion, then it's not about presence, unless it's present on Sunday morning while we do our hocus pocus and you feel good about yourself. But yeah. In terms of presence in you and learning to live out of that fullness in life, we've taken that away. We've given you the comfort of certainty. Jump through these hoops. Now you get to go to heaven. So you're good there and you're forgiven. So don't worry about that stuff. And we've given this comfort that hasn't led us to presence.
Mm.
And I think that's true. Why we can't talk about religion and politics, because I think we can talk about both. The fact is most people in a religion or a political discussion don't give respect to people who see the world differently than they do.
Correct.
And when there's a lack of respect, then it's just about coercion and pressure, and you're an idiot if you don't see it the way I do. I was in chemo last week for the first time in 3 months because we were on our trip. And then the nurse we had, and we've had great nurses at this clinic where they do these things. We had the most wonderful lady who, in the midst of doing what she does, and she was good at not making it as pain-free as possible, which I appreciate.
Yep.
And then while she's injecting the stuff in me that takes like 4.5 minutes to get it in there, she's talking about her faith journey. And she's she grew up Catholic, and she's kind of given up on the whole God thing. And so she was talking about my God journey, and I'm in this amazing conversation with somebody who's not in the same camp I'm in. And we could talk about it without a lack of respect and without me trying to coerce her into something to save her soul, just to let God make himself known, to trust presence. And I think religion kind of moves us off of that, where we're not trusting presence, we're trusting that we've jumped through these hoops in the right way.
It's such a flat counterfeit, right? It's such a flat substitute, because I mean, I get the knowing and some of the appearance of control, the illusion of control. And yet it's like, when you've encountered authentic presence, it just tastes like sawdust in my mouth. It's like, why would I want to chew on that more? Like it's just
law. Not presence. Like, you're just talking about the religion aspect.
Yes, the religion. Like, why would I want to chew on that in comparison to drinking the water of life and being in that presence and enjoying and resting in that space? Man, to enjoy living water versus sawdust, it's two different worlds.
It is. And we did a podcast a long time ago about it. It's not chocolate, talking about kids playing with dog poo and it may look like chocolate. And did a whole podcast on it, which was hilarious. If you've never known presence, if it's just been, you know, goosebumps in a service of some kind, but you've never known God at work in you, the reality of that, what you just said, if you've never had living water, sawdust, sometimes that's all it's supposed to have. This is it. I've got, and I know a lot of people who've said, man, I figured that's what everybody else was experiencing. So I'm pretending like they're pretending that it's really, really good stuff instead of, no, come on. There's something so real that when it captures your heart, you're transformed from the inside. And it's not about performing on the outside. And it's not about people exploiting my need to belong to get me to be part of a group and be active when I'm doing stuff on the outside that isn't real on the inside.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we made conversion that way. We, you know, here's the hoops. Now you're forgiven. Now you got your get out of hell free card. Instead of, how do I help you discover presence? And once you discover presence, now you'll have a way to live the rest of your life inside that reality. And I wish that's how we started. With people, we just went, once it got to be a religion, then it was, okay, here's what you believe, and here's what you do. This is a good Christian, this is a bad Christian. And then it came all about conformity. Instead of, it's about presence. I will give you my spirit. He will dwell in me. He will guide you into all truth. Not a religious teacher, not a Bible interpreter, not the Bible itself, but my spirit will guide you into all truth. That's what Jesus left us with. And unfortunately, we put substitutes in place for that because Partly because I don't think we can control presence. So yeah.
Yes,
you can have an illusion of presence, but you can't really control it. So if you just have systems in place, systems of conversion and systems of discipleship and things you can do and control on your own, then, oh, okay, so this is what we've got. It's really good. Instead of, no, this is not it.
Well, and even like I heard a really sad story just today from class, because there's also, once they've gotten you into the conversion, then on the backside, they use fear to hold you in that conversion to that religion. And I was listening to a really sad story. One of my students was sharing about their primary caregiver growing up, and major part of their life, huge positive influence in their life. And this individual looked their adoptive child in the eye and said, if you ever become an atheist, I will never speak to you again. And I was like, whoa, like instead of trusting in the faith, the value and the beauty and the quality of the faith that you converted this individual to, instead you use a statement like, if you ever walk away from this faith, if you ever become an atheist, I will never speak to you again. Oh my gosh. Like what? Like why would you ever need to say that to somebody that you love if you have pointed them to a faith that is authentic?
Well, you haven't. See, now you know that's what keeps them in check. Mm. It's the threat and fear that keeps me saved. So I've got to put that on you, because you're going to go through stuff like I went through, which if you don't have enough threat in mind, you're going to, and then they amp it up, not with just, you know, your life could go into turmoil, but I'm going to cut you out of my heart and life. And I think that's the double speak of Christianity. All God loves you. He loves you so much. But if you don't get it right, he's going to throw you into hell forever. And he's going to torment you. And it's from the very beginning, it's a conflict about the nature of God. And someone pointed out recently, there's not one reference to hell in any of the sermons in the book of Acts. This is about being engaged with the Savior. It's not about escaping something horrible.
Yeah.
And we have so misconstrued that. Most people who don't have presence live by fear. And that's why helping people discover presence is so important. Not about, let's just pray a sinner's prayer, get a baptism, let's go through these hoops, and now you're good. It's to say, okay, how do we discover presence? And baptism is part of that. And the fullness of the Holy Spirit is part of that fullness again. It's being filled up on God so that now you have something to live for, not something you're running from. And if we haven't tasted of that, then you can't give it to someone else. The only reason I'm staying saved is fear of the opposite, fear of the other side of that. Then that's what I'm going to pass on to the people. I got to make them afraid too. That's sad.
So if that has been your norm, If that has been, I mean, we talked a little bit about in class today, the conflict currently going on in Israel and Gaza. And I asked one of my class, does Israel have any ally that borders them that like really wants to see them succeed? Because this individual was very strongly against the actions that Israel has been taking over the last few months. And so I said, is there anybody around them that really is excited about them existing and wanting them to continue and to thrive? And the student kind of paused and was like, well, no. And I said, yeah. So imagine generation after generation after generation living in a space where you are told we are surrounded by enemies, and the only thing we have is ourselves. And if we don't look out for ourselves and very passionately and unrelentingly and brutally defend ourselves, nobody else is coming for us because we're surrounded by enemies. And I thought about that in the context of Christianity as well. Like if the perspective for multiple generations is, it's been said, okay, we're surrounded by enemies. We're in the world, right? But not of it. So we're surrounded by enemies all the time. And so we have to constantly live in this state of fear, readiness, warfare, whatever, because we're surrounded by enemies. what happens when God's love runs into that, pokes holes in that, and disrupts it? Where do you go from there when you've got multiple generations of your norm being that worldview, and then all of a sudden God's like, I'm gonna poke a hole there. Okay. And all of a sudden his kingdom light starts to shine through that.
Yeah. And what does that do?
Yeah. Like what, I mean, what does somebody who God's starting to poke those holes in that after potentially multiple generations of living in this fear space, how do they start to accept or receive the light versus seeing the light as the enemy? Right. Because often God starts poking holes in our perceptions, our worldviews that let his kingdom in, that let his light in, that let our minds understand that there is access to his dwelling. And yet often we perceive that light as more of a threat than we do as hope.
I think if you see it as a threat, you're going to get the duct tape out and you're going to plug up the hole so the light doesn't get in.
That's fair.
I think it's sad because I think that's what I've grown up in. I've grown up in a Christian world of increasing fear about what the world's doing around us.
Yeah.
And the things it's making us do and accept and be part of. And that fear has motivated them to do all kinds of things. And particularly, we're going to prevail over the world. We're going to take dominion. And now we're going to act in the opposite of where Jesus called us to act, which is, I want you to lay down your life for the good of people around you. I want you to live a life different than taking power into our hands and making the world in our image. That's not how the new covenant works. Mm-hmm. But if you've been motivated by fear all your life, and many Christians I grew up with still are motivated by fear, they've never had the endearment of presence that was greater than the fear of God and what he might do if I step out in the wrong place, or the fear of what the world's trying to do to separate me from God. And when you live out of fear all your life, when you live out of threat, and that's trauma right there.
Yes.
Everything's a threat. And now I'm reacting to all that stuff in the sense that God seems absent. And I know I believe in him and he's out there somewhere and he's going to win it at the end of the day. But today he's not here. He's not enough to get me through what's going on. And so in my fear and panic, and then you add to that, God is demanding that we present our culture to him righteous through law and manipulation and control. Then you've perfectly set up for exactly what's going on in our world, which it's not about presence and endearment. And God has captured my heart. Now, how do I live? Going back to some of the just love stuff that we're going, how do I live as a just person in an unjust world? And the answer is not take control and make the unjust just. It didn't happen by externals. That the whole message of the scriptures is, it can't happen outside in. Jesus came to do it inside out. Learn love, learn compassion, not fear, not paranoia. Not I've got to destroy the world around me before it destroys me, but I'm going to live as a just person in an unjust world and watch the kingdom come in ways that we can't imagine. And if you don't have that, then you're left to react out of fear, and no one can shake you from it. You know, when fear is your guiding force, when being threatened is your guiding force, and God's part of that, and the world's part of that, and even other Christians holding you accountable is part of that, then your body never relaxes enough into love and peace and goodness. And God's bigger than what's going on around you. You can live in his love today toward people, and not that you have enemies, not that these people are my enemies because they're doing certain things I don't like.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of it is, like, when you said it's trauma, I just started chuckling because I was like, yeah, that's when you perceive the entire world as a threat, except for your exclusive group of us versus them, right? Then your head is constantly on a swivel. And I was just like chuckling to myself because I was like, God, thank you for all of the corrective experiences that I've had with people in the world that did not believe and do not believe the same that I do, that do not have the same worldview that I do, and yet they are not the enemy either. Like, I have great friendships with them. I experience deep affection and care and love for them, and they are in my camp, quote unquote, and I use major air quotes there. They're not in my camp. And yet it's like, these people have had a profound and positive and powerful impacts on my lives in incredible ways. And those are those corrective experiences that I love, because once you get, that's one of the perceptions that I feel like God just took a cannon and blasted a hole in, was, no, my beloved are all around you. They're not just in your church walls. They're not just in your youth group or just in your community group or your small group or whatever. My beloved are all around you, and they have things that they can teach you, that they have things that you do not hold, that they want to share with you. And yes, they don't wear the same brands, they don't wear the same titles, they don't use the same language, and yet they are my beloved. And they, gosh, like encountering the flavor and life of Christ in people in the world that would not fall in the big air quotes Christianese camp was so disruptive to my worldview. It's like, how can that be? How can you have fun? How can you be loving? How can you be creative? How can you be so compassionate? How can you be so passionate about the injustices in the world if you aren't a small town conservative evangelical Christian? How is that possible? I don't understand. And yet, man, God used.
There's the contradiction right there.
Oh, exactly.
Drive them nuts. You're a vice president this week invoked the Catholic concept of Ordo Amoris?
No.
I heard it. I'm going to go, okay, what's this about? Ordo Amoris is something that St. Thomas Aquinas kind of pulled it out.
Okay.
It's the order of love. So you order love, like you owe love to your family and your community, mm-hmm. and then maybe beyond that to some point to other people. But he invoked this because people were saying, what about love for these immigrants that you're just, even if they're here illegally, you're just driving them out in terror. And he invoked saying, and this is what he said. This is an interview with Sean Hannity. He said, the far left in the United States tend to have more compassion for people residing in the country illegally, including those who have committed crimes, than they do American citizens. So the idea in this order of love is there's people you get to love because they're close to you. So family, you got to care about your family more than you care about a family in Burma or someplace else or whatever they call that country now. It was such a neat way to do exactly what you were saying is a problem. We can order people that, yeah, I have to love American citizens more than I love the non-citizens among us or the non-legal among us. So I don't have to love them. And then the accusation is, well, the left loves them more. And they always talk about this far left. Anybody disagrees with them is far extremist left, which is bizarre. But I thought it was interesting that what Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, both of them kind of took a place in this, was to think about what loves are more important than other loves. Mm. And what do you love that you're not supposed to love? And they were talking about loving justice over expedience. And talking about an entirely different thing than just, okay, here's who you have to love, and here's a good Christian. You don't have to love those people because you just can't love everyone. When Jesus said, love what's right in front of you, the Good Samaritan story is about loving the person that's different from you, different culture, not, and yet this gets all twisted again. So we can love the home team and we can threaten and berate the away team. And it's tragic.
But the whole point of why the Good Samaritan was so provocative is because there was nothing about the guy on the side of the road that was in their camp. Nothing.
Nothing.
There was absolutely not my family, nothing.
Not my nationality. Not nothing. Yeah. In fact, he's an outcast type.
Absolutely. He has a social disregard. And that's why it was so provocative, was because he's sharing this parable. And here's all of these people that should have, you know, reached out to him. And yet it's like, no, now here is the person who's caring for him and is the person that is not in our camp, and yet it is blowing a hole in our perception of what a neighborly love might look like in the world around us.
And it's a pretty distorted view of love to say, I can withhold it from you because I don't have enough to spend on them, the people that's closest to me. Instead of, no, it's love. Love, if it's real in our heart, it's not selective about who it goes to. It's not, okay, well, you're just a chemo nurse, so it doesn't go there. Or you're just my neighbor, and you look different than me, and you do different stuff than I like, so I don't have to do that either. Love, real love, and when your life in God is based on love and not on threat and fear, you don't portion out love. You love one another is who's in front of me now, and what life can I share with them? What gift can I share? And not, I've got to convert them because then I can have a basis to love them. I just get to love them and let the life of Jesus be demonstrated. And then maybe at some point they're, I want what you have. What do you know about life that makes your life work better than mine's working?
Yeah.
And we've missed that. And I think the psychosis of all the fear that we put on the Christian experience for so many people, whether it's fear of hell or fear of being out of God's favor, or fear what point do I'm not doing enough of the Jesus things that count, that make me part of the in crowd, and then I'm judging people who are on the out crowd because they don't do as much as I'm doing. And all that fear has led to a psychosis that makes us unable to love the way we are loved. Because now Jesus didn't come with, yeah, only you and not you. He did come for the Israel, but other people kept chiming in on that. You can't not love the centurion, can't not love the woman, the Syrophoenician woman, can't not, because love is love. And it's there for the next person that needs it. It's not there for me to go, okay, you I get to love, and I don't think I'm going to love you today because you're not one of the ones I'm responsible to love. That just says you haven't experienced love, because when you do, you can't apportion it.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.